From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The ideas of Sigmund Freud were never a great fit in America. His despairing theories about human happiness went up against the country's compulsion for it. In a new article for Harper's Magazine, the psychoanalyst and writer Paul Greenberg says Freud figured we were all hopelessly complex or helplessly enthralled to the chaotic forces of the unconscious. But he says there's a new sensibility emerging in psychology that is rejecting this gloomy outlook and embracing something more positive, a science of happiness. Today in the program, Greenberg will join us to talk about the evolution of therapy away from the abstract and open-ended to something more concrete and measurable. He calls his piece The War on Unhappiness. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We should have known that a country with happiness embedded in its creed would have a hard time with the hopelessly gloomy theories of Sigmund Freud. In a new article for Harper's Magazine, the psychoanalyst and writer Paul Greenberg explains how Freud saw human contentment as hopelessly complex, that we were all bound to the chaotic forces of the unconscious. He says that Freud's central taboo was certainty, that he doubted any of these forces could be completely given to science or medicine. But Greenberg says and writes about a new sensibility that's emerging in psychology, one that is rejecting this gloomy outlook and embracing something more positive, a science of happiness. Today in the program, Greenberg is joining us to talk about his ideas in the article. We invite you to join the conversation with questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Gary Greenberg is a contributor to Harper's Magazine, the author of two books. His most recent is called Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. And he's joining us today from his office in New London, Connecticut. Gary Greenberg, welcome to the program. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. I'm glad to be here.
I want to begin as you do in the piece, you begin with Sigmund Freud, already 53, you say, when he came to America for the first time, September 1909, and the event was a big deal. People were sort of, I guess, anxious to hear from Freud and his ideas.
I think that's right. Freud was a curiosity among American intellectuals at that time, and they'd only heard indirectly through what they've been able to read, and again, only those who could read German were able to gather. And so they convened in Worcester, Massachusetts. The occasion was a celebration of the 20th anniversary of Clark University. And there was a lot of anticipation around Freud's visit.
What were the what happened, essentially? You talk about he gave these five lectures, and essentially he was laying out the basics for psychoanalysis.
Yeah, he gave the, you know, psychoanalysis 101 at the time. Of course, psychoanalysis evolved much more in the next 25 or 30 years of Freud's life, but he gave a snapshot of how he was thinking about psychological suffering, its causes, and its remedies at the time. And he laid it out in a very straightforward fashion.
Mm. The essence of, I guess, of the story for Freud was that, as you say in the article, traumatic memories come from what he called this enduring repressed wishes of childhood, and not only that, but they were invariably of a sexual nature.
Yeah, well, what he said was that our patients are suffering from reminiscences.
Yeah.
And what he meant by that was not only that people had memories that bothered them, but that the particular memories that bothered people the most, which were the ones that they essentially had to forget, were traumatic, not only because of the bad things that might have happened, the thing that they're actually remembering, but because they awaken certain instincts and certain feelings that people might wish they don't have.
Mm.
And so, you know, the classic example is the awakening of sexuality in a child via incest. Mm. And Freud would say that that was a problem, not only because people shouldn't commit incest and because that's thing that parents shouldn't do to their children, but also because it prematurely and traumatically awakens the sexual instinct that is already there in the child. Mm.
And so I guess the idea, the principal idea is that there is, if I'm getting this right, essentially no cure for unhappiness, that there the idea is we're perpetual uncertainty, I think is how you put it. Is
well, what Freud was getting at, and even in 1909 at these lectures, he was pretty clear about it, was that the human being is kind of a strange hybrid of animal and something else, and that in order to live in the world of humans, we have to curtail our instincts. Otherwise, life would be nasty, brutish, and short, as Thomas Hobbes said. We have to engage in civilization. We have to restrain ourselves. And when we do that, Freud said, there's a price that we pay, which is that, in effect, we psychologically mutilate ourselves. You know, this is what circumcision would be a symbol of this, that we psychologically mutilate ourselves in order to get along. And the thing that we mutilate, the thing that we lose, is our instinctual life. We have to relegate that to the background. And Freud wasn't saying this is a bad thing. Yeah. He was just saying it's a painful thing, it's a difficult thing, and that by doing it, we achieve something, that is civilization, which he thinks is wonderful and sublime, but we also lose something, which means that the process of seeking, of being civilized, of being human, is also, in its essence, tragic. Mm. And so to talk about curing us is really, in Freud's view, ridiculous, because you're not going to be cured of who we're not going to be cured of who we are, essentially. We're not going to be this strange hybrid thing that we are isn't going to change. We're not going to be cured of the human condition.
How did these upbeat Americans take to this idea? I mean, how were people thinking about Freud? And, certainly, at least in that time.
Well, at that time, in America, there was a great deal of full interest in the idea of psychological suffering that couldn't really be explained. In particular, there had been epidemics of a couple of diseases, hysteria and neurasthenia, both diseases we don't really talk about anymore because they seem to have disappeared. But around the turn of the century, these were epidemic proportions, especially among what we would call today the information workers, the brain workers. These disorders would consist of a kind of malaise or a fatigue, sometimes with physical symptoms, paralysis or numbness. And in general, they would drive people to the doctor, and the doctor would not know what to do with them until certain cures were proposed, like rest cures or spa cures, or there were others that were even more outlandish. And Freud's theory was very interesting to people because he said that he was explaining why people might, even if they're functioning well and even if they're at the top of their society, why they might still be suffering from unexplained symptoms. And the theory was that it was because the demands of civilization were getting them. The demands of civilization were causing them to repress their instincts so much that they were paying the price. And so in a society, a medical world where neurasthenia and hysteria were epidemic, this approach seemed very promising.
In the article, you fast forward to this experience where you go to this conference on psychotherapy in Anaheim. And you're kind of wandering the halls of this place, and you see the kind of the vast number of different kinds of theories and practices, Ericksonian hypnosis and Gestalt therapy and Buddhist psychology and meditative methods. What were you seeing there? I guess these sort of myriad ways of trying to deal with all of this uncertainty. What were you seeing essentially?
Well, I was seeing a couple of things. First of all, I was seeing how, because I'm a member of the profession, I've been practicing psychotherapy for 27 years, but I was wandering around this conference as a visitor, as a journalist, I was sort of seeing how my profession might look to an outsider, and I have to say that I wasn't feeling very good about the way my profession would look to an outsider. There is this combination of what appears to be, you know, at least on the surface of it, kind of quackery, and this very commercial orientation toward selling the latest kind of mind cure. And to me, that just looked more than faintly ridiculous. So that was one thing that I was seeing. Another thing that I was seeing that was really interesting to me was just the sheer profusion of these psychotechnologies, of the ways that people would approach people's psychological suffering, and how each one is held by its originator or its practitioners as the solution to people's psychological suffering. And what a cacophony this was, and what a strange cacophony. And it reminded me of the Tower of Babel, because there was this reaching toward the sky that had collapsed into this chaos.
And which led to, as you say, sort of the dodo bird effect, this idea that everyone has won and all must have prizes. All of these orientations work.
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is that you have, you know, everything from, like, plug yourself into this machine and read your brainwaves to, you know, primal scream, and everything in between, encompassing Deepak Chopra and Andrew Weil, who were at this conference, and the whole range of American therapies. And what's really interesting about that is that to the extent that these various treatments have been tested, they all work. And this has been true, been tested for many years. The first time the outcomes were tested was in 1937. And it turns out that what was really needed for therapy to work isn't the particular technique or the particular understanding of the origins of suffering. What really is necessary is for the therapist to believe in what he or she is doing, and for the patient to believe in his or her therapist. That's the one variable that seems to matter. And really, that's just a very polite way of saying that therapy works by the placebo effect. And wandering around this convention, one of the things that struck me is how magnificent the placebo effect is. The fact that a healing relationship can be so powerful, even if the content of it appears to be malarkey.
So it's so interesting the way you write about the piece. You're very circumspect, in some ways troubled by what you're seeing, and we'll break down some of the things that have troubled you by what you're seeing. But as you said, you're also, I don't want to say a believer if we're talking about faith, but you're certainly in the profession itself. What was the thing that led you to start thinking about this and to write this article?
Well, you know, because I practice this strange profession, and I often wonder, what am I doing here? You know, people come to see me, and I listen to them, and I talk to them, and I'm honest with them, and sometimes it seems like this is a great thing, and other times I step back from it and think, okay, what is this really about? And I think I'm by nature a fairly contrarian person, and so I don't accept a lot of the explanations, at least not at face value, for why therapy works or how it's supposed to work. And so this article was really an opportunity for me to just go and see what's going on out there in my profession, and to sort of check my own sense of how this works or how it doesn't work.
Gary Greenberg is with us. He's a practicing psychotherapist, a contributor to Harper's Magazine. His article is called The War on Unhappiness, Goodbye Freud, Hello Positive Thinking. It appears in the September issue. We invite you to join the conversation with questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Gary Greenberg. Yeah, we're talking about his article in the September issue of Harper's Magazine. It's an analysis of the state of psychology in America today. Gary Greenberg is joining us. His piece is called The War on Unhappiness, Goodbye Freud, Hello Positive Thinking. And Gary Greenberg, I think I called you Paul Greenberg before, forgive me. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You write in the article that Freud was pretty adamant that the science of medicine was not really, if I get it right anyway, the kind of the proper format for psychoanalysis, that you had to have kind of an understanding of the more abstract arts, you know, sociology, art, culture.
I think Freud believed that the best preparation for being a psychoanalyst was what we would today call a classic liberal arts education.
Yeah.
You know, to be schooled in the major works of Western civilization, literature, art, religion. So, and he believed that the training for a doctor, and he was a doctor, so he knew this firsthand,
yeah,
was probably exactly the wrong training to be a therapist. This came to a head because in 1926, the psychoanalysts in New York, so this is 17 years after Freud's visit, psychoanalysis is becoming established in this country, and the psychoanalysts in New York, who were all psychiatrists, tried to claim psychoanalysis as their own, to say that nobody but psychiatrists could practice it, that it was a form of medical treatment, and that anybody practicing psychoanalysis outside of that was basically practicing medicine without a license.
Mm.
And Freud was very upset about this. In fact, he wrote a whole book about it called The Question of Lay Analysis. And his idea was that, you know, if medicine swallows psychoanalysis, then it's going to be a bad thing, because all of a sudden what we'll have is doctors looking for problems, looking for the thing that they can cure, looking for the cause of the disease and seeking to eliminate it. And in Freud's view, that was a mistake.
But it's what happened, though, wasn't it, here in America?
Yeah, it's what happened. I mean, the psychiatrists won. Freud couldn't stop them from claiming psychoanalysis as their own. And indeed, the medical profession took over psychoanalysis and eventually the various therapies that it spawned in the 30s and 40s.
And I guess the question is this to the good? Because you write about the fact that in the past, I think 30 years or so, there's been a kind of focus on reorienting this to being able to measure it. It's sort of coming under more scrutiny. How do we measure all of this?
Well, look, a therapist should be accountable.
Sure.
But the question is, to whom?
Right.
And under what circumstances? The thing that's really interesting here is that because the doctors claim psychoanalysis, or to put it another way, because psychotherapy got in bed with medicine,
There's
this kind of unholy marriage. It was not a very good match to begin with. I mean, we're not treating the kinds of diseases that can be quantified and looked at under a microscope and treated with, you know, antibiotics or whatever. But the single most important result of the doctors getting in bed with the therapist is that we get paid by the insurance companies.
Yeah.
And so that's been the major benefit of it, and that's what's driven the success of therapy in this country, is that we can get paid a fairly high wage because we get third-party payments. Now, I'm not going to complain too loud about that, but I am going to point it out that this is how I make part of my living. I actually keep the insurance part of my practice pretty low-key, but this is how I make part of my living, and it's certainly what keeps our wages up high.
Mm.
But the price that we pay for that is, sooner or later, some, you know, accountant is going to say, quite rightly, well, what's our money going for?
Yeah.
When we're treating pneumonia, we know what that money's going for. What's our money going for with therapy? What are these guys treating? How are they treating it? What are the results? And this question started to be asked in earnest in the 1970s. And at around the same time that the psychiatric profession was in a crisis, because it had turned out that psychiatrists didn't agree on, you know, a given patient, what the given patient's diagnosis would be, one psychiatrist would differ from another.
Mm.
Nor could they even agree on what a mental illness was, because at the time they thought homosexuality was a mental illness.
Right.
So the profession was in deep trouble. And that was when the call for accountability came to, quite naturally, to resemble the call for accountability in the rest of medicine. Show me what your illnesses are, show me what you're doing for them, and show me the results. And in the last 30 years or so, for lots of different reasons, there's been at least one major branch of therapy, that is cognitive behavioral therapy or cognitive therapy, that has responded to that by quantifying and standardizing psychotherapy.
It's you write about being at the conference, one psychologist there, a man from Illinois, is asking therapists, okay, write down two numbers. One is the percentage of their patients who actually get better. And the other number is write down the percentile in which you would rank yourselves as clinicians. And how are colleagues ranking themselves? What does that tell you?
Well, first I have to tell you what I gave myself,
yeah.
Right? So I gave myself a 70, which I thought was, you know, that was like the lowest that I could live with and the highest that I could live with, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought a gentleman's C. It turns out that if you ask that question to a representative sample of therapists, the general both numbers come out in the 80s.
Right.
And as this guy rightly pointed out, that's just impossible. Everybody can't be above average. There have to be average therapists. There have to be below average therapists. There have to be above average therapists. And his point in saying this was that we're still, after all of this, not very good at being accountable. And more to the point, he was saying, this means that therapists are not motivated to achieve excellence. And if they are motivated to achieve excellence, they don't really know how to go about it.
So is he right? Scott Miller is the name of the psychologist. Is he right that the field is kind of stuck?
Well, the numbers are always the same. You know,
yeah.
Something like 3/4 of the patients who come into therapy benefit in some way, according to the patients. And that number has been pretty consistent for a long time. So in that sense, the profession is stuck. I think the question I would ask is, do we have to get unstuck?
Right. Or is this the nature of things?
What's that?
Or is this just the nature of things?
Yeah, because, again, we're not necessarily dealing with a skill. There are skills in what I do, but we're not necessarily dealing with a skill akin to one of the examples let me back up. Erickson believes that if we rely on theories that have been developed about how people achieve superior performance by a fellow named Anders Ericsson, that expertise is basically the same thing across all domains.
Right.
And so Ericsson has worked with people to extend their ability to memorize long strings of numbers. And it turns out that with the right techniques, you can do that. Well, generalizing from this, Ericsson has developed a whole strategy to developing excellence in performance. And this can be applied, according to Scott Miller, this can be applied to therapy. So the question is, I believe that's probably true, that you can do that. But the question is, when you do that, in what way do you change therapy?
Right.
You obviously have to orient it toward those skills that can be taught and away from this, what I was calling earlier, this placebo effect.
Right.
They're trying to isolate and identify an active ingredient in therapy, and you can do that, but by doing it, you've changed what therapy is.
Mm. So which raises the question, it seems, what makes, you know, an effective, good therapist? Is it a feel thing, an abstract connection that relies, you know, less on training as on, you know, personality or rapport?
You know, I think a good therapist is somebody who's learned how to expand his range of loving people.
Mm.
You know, if you think about it, why do you fall in love with one person and you don't fall in love with another person? Who the heck knows?
Yeah.
I mean, really. Why do I, you know, a friend of mine says, this is my new girlfriend, and I look and I think, what the hell are you doing? You know,
yeah.
Or he says that and I say, oh, wow, I'm going to fall in love with her too. I mean, nobody knows how that happens. And when it happens, if everything is in good order and you're lucky, it can turn into a transformative experience in your life. What therapists can do that I think is important is that they can expand their ability to accept and show love to a much wider range of people than most people can. And I don't know if that can be taught. I'm sure there's parts of it that can be taught. But, you know, it's not only that can it be taught. It's a question, do you really want to do that? Because there's a lot of burden that goes along with that.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Dez, who's joining us in Salt Lake. Dez, welcome to the program.
Hi, Doug. I just was wondering, I'm currently rereading an oldie but goodie, Dale Carnegie's How to Stop Worrying and How to Start Living. And he gives simple, straightforward advice of how to overcome obstacles and basically just says happiness is from within. And it takes action on the individual's part. And I just want to know, where does psychotherapy and psychoanalysis stop and psychobabble start?
That's a good question. Dale Carnegie comes up. Gary Greenberg?
I love that question. that's a delightful question. I mean, I don't know the answer, you know, where one stops and the other starts, but there's no question that one of the things I encountered at this conference was tremendous amounts of psychobabble, which is partly because there are people out there babbling, but also because anytime you start to try to really talk about therapy, you run the risk of babbling, even if the idea was good in the first place. But as to the connection with Dale Carnegie, that's very actually much more profound than perhaps Dez is aware, and that is that one of the results of all of this reorientation of the field is that the predominant model is not the Freudian model anymore, where, you know, people are thought of as these sort of tragic figures and we're muddling through and the best we can hope for is common unhappiness as opposed to neurotic misery, which is how Freud put it. Instead, what is happening is that psychotherapy is becoming a technology for achieving happiness.
Yeah.
And in many respects, directly resembles the things that both Dale Carnegie and Norman Vincent Peale were saying in America in the, you know, the sort of the middle years of the 20th century. Carnegie was a little earlier than Peale, which is that if you set your mind to it, you can do anything.
Yeah.
And in particular, if you're not happy, it's because you're not really using your mind to make yourself happy. And I think more and more therapy is turning, in at least what I was witnessing at the conference, that's what therapy is turning into.
Is this an American dynamic, or is this happening everywhere else?
Well, I hear from my colleagues overseas that it's an American dynamic. I don't have like enough firsthand experience to say so, but what we can notice is that it certainly dovetails nicely with that strain of relentless optimism that is so prevalent in our culture and sometimes reasonably annoying, at least to somebody like me.
You know, it's interesting. You write about David Burns, this professor of psychology at Stanford, who his impression is that some of these schools of therapy compete like religious cults almost. And he says in some ways that some therapists sort of their ideas about all of this is the result of their allegiance to their orientation, to their particular type of therapy. They believe their patients are getting better when they're not. And I wanted you to talk about that. It's interesting.
Okay, so first of all, any given therapy could be, you know, what's called in the literature a folie à deux, so two people that have a shared hallucination that things are getting better.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's lots of ways that can happen, and sometimes they can be destructive. I think Burns is onto something there. I also think that the idea that we come to therapy purely as technocrats without any pre-existing beliefs or without any idea that there's a kind of human being that we think we ought to be and that the person who's with us, the patient, is suffering because in some way they've failed to achieve that kind of selfhood. Mm. Any therapist who doesn't believe that is deluding himself. I mean, we all have a working model of what a person ought to be. And so I think that, and that roughly translates to your orientation.
Yeah.
Right? And to say that you're not going to have an orientation, it's so blandly ecumenical as to be meaningless. And I think that I think that Burns is fooling himself about that. He's also trying to make a pitch for measuring therapy like Miller, who we were talking about before, in terms of skills and in terms of outcomes. So the move to accountability turns into a change in the whole nature of therapy.
It's interesting to say Burns himself has his own kind of school of therapy. I mean, he has his own techniques. He has this, what he calls this emotional X-ray machine, which is, in essence, this kind of very directed quiz, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, he shows us that if you ask people to rate their therapist and their therapy session after every session and along certain very simple dimensions, you will derive an ability to sort of link up the techniques that you used with the outcome, and therefore, through a quick process, like a troubleshooting chart, you'll be able to get to what the problem is, or at least what works for the problem. But, you know, in one of my favorite moments of the whole conference, in the breath after he said that that orientations are a bad thing, he asked us to recite in unison his five steps to agenda setting.
Right.
So, you know, that kind of, you wonder why people's heads don't blow up in the presence of that level of self-contradiction.
We should say thanks to Des. Thanks very much for the call, by the way. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Shay is with us, calling from Cedar City, Utah. Shay, welcome.
Hey, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Hey, I wanted to make a comment. A recent caller asked the question, where does the psychobabble begin and where does the psychology end and the psychobabble begin? I just wanted to make the comment that I am a new therapist. I graduated about a year ago and have been practicing since, but I run into that question a lot, and it seems to me like a lot of people, maybe especially in our idyllic little culture that we live in here, are really afraid that mental illness really exists, that this isn't a personal decision, that this is not, these are not the consequences of a life poorly led, but that mental illness can strike anyone, anytime, anywhere. And, you know, that's my take on it, is that I think a lot of people are truly afraid of mental illness, and if they believe that this is all voodoo and snake oil, they don't have to be afraid of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Gary Greenberg, what do you think?
Well, I think that there's a couple of really interesting ideas there. The first one has to do with what it is that people are afraid of when it comes to mental illness. As therapy has changed over the years, so has our sense of what mental illness is. And it's become more and more a biological thing, something bad that goes wrong with your brain. And that sort of taking drugs and learning certain coping techniques, there's not much you can do about it. And so it does strike you, no matter what your circumstances, in the same way that diabetes or cancer does. And there's more and more focus on psychobiology as time goes on. So that's one change that reinforces this idea that we can approach our mental illnesses as sort of freestanding, our mental suffering as sort of freestanding illnesses. We don't have to really think too much about the context or about the relationship between the therapist and the patient.
Shay, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Back to the phones. Dennis is with us in Layton, Utah. Dennis, hi.
Hi, I have a question. Has there been any studies that show that therapy actually makes people happier? And what I mean is therapy is a singular thing, not as, you know, as a control from actions and people changing their life circumstances, if that makes sense.
Does that make sense, Gary Greenberg?
Yeah, the question, I think the question is there, are there any studies that show that therapy is the thing that makes the difference in the lives of the people who are in it? And the answer is that, you know, some studies are better controlled than others. I think the most interesting study is the one the Consumer Reports did a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. They undertook this question and used real psychologists to go out and find out. And, yeah, I mean, it turns out that, of course, it depends on what the measures are, but in general, people report that being in therapy makes a positive difference in their lives, again, at this sort of 70% rate. You know, some people people would say, well, that's certainly better than, you know, your average antidepressant does.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's only a C. It's not an A. So.
And it's built on that, going back to that idea you were talking about before, it's built on faith, the faith that you have in your therapist and the faith that the therapist has in the technique that he or she is approaching. Is that
and,
right?
And another thing that might happen in the course of therapy is that your definition of happiness might change.
Yeah.
So that, you know, if it may not be what you expected on the other side. And that would make a critic say quite cogently, well, then what therapy is a sort of a conversion process. You change what people expect from their lives, and then you help them achieve that.
Yeah.
And I think there's some truth to that.
Mm. Dennis, thanks. Let's go back to the phones. Gregory with us in Midvale, Utah. Gregory, welcome.
Hi. Long-time listener, first-time caller. My question is this. I mean, just going off this notion of happiness, you know, for Freud and psychoanalysis, the real goal was to uncover the truth of the individual, no matter how happy or unhappy that truth might be. But in this case, hasn't the move away from that sort of practice or methodology made psychology, psychiatry, and psychoanalysis instead more a notion of pushing one's conception of happiness on, you know, the subject?
Well, you know what I want to say about that is that I think that's always been the case, that's unavoidable. If you go into therapy with somebody, the therapist has an idea of where your life has sort of gone off the rails and how it should be put back, and you can't really do that without an understanding of how a human life, a particular human life, if not human life in general, should go. But I also think that what's changed since Freud's visit to America is exactly what the caller was just talking about, the idea that what we're after is the truth. That is no longer as important as it used to be. There's plenty of evidence that people who perceive the truth of a situation tend to be more depressed, more psychologically speaking, unhealthy, than the people who don't. And that's an important finding because so much of current therapy, particularly cognitive therapy, focuses on people sort of thinking themselves out of their unhappiness or their suffering, even to some extent against the evidence. So this is sort of the end of Freud's tragic view. It's been replaced by this other view, which is that, you know, there's a lot of things about life that are pretty bad, but we don't really have to think about them that way.
Gregory, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Gary Greenberg is with us. His article is called The War on Unhappiness, Goodbye Freud, Hello Positive Thinking. It appears in the September issue of Harper's Magazine. It's on newsstands in most places. We'll be shortly anyway. We need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Gary Greenberg. He is a psychoanalyst and journalist, author of the article in the September issue of Harper's Magazine called The War on Unhappiness. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Chris is with us in Baltimore, Maryland. Chris, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is this. The majority of people I know, including myself, experience psychological suffering through the vehicle of relationships, that is, family relationships. I don't know anybody who has what they would call an ideal set of family relationships. Now, I've never been in therapy, but I examine myself a lot, and I tend to see in myself this really strong, call it mirror neurons or this empathic response, but none of my moods or none of my happiness occurs in a vacuum. It all has to do with others around me and those people that I love, and whether or not they are suffering or appear to be happy, and I wonder if you could address that.
So I guess what you're getting at there is the way that our lives really depend on the close relationships that we have. At least that's how I understand the comment, and I think that's true. And I think that that's one of the reasons that the idea of therapy operating or succeeding because of the relationship with the therapist, that's one of the reasons that it's so powerful, is because at its best, what therapy is an opportunity to learn how to be in relationships, namely the relationship with the therapist. This is something that Freud first identified. He called it transference, which is, you know, sort of a fancy name, but basically it just means whatever goes on between the therapist and the patient. Or, you know, the more modern equivalent, an analyst in England, Adam Phillips, who says therapy is what happens when two people agree not to have sex. So, which, you know, sounds sort of flip, but it's true.
Yeah.
It's true that when you decide to have a very particular and peculiar form of intimacy, that could be both educational, I guess is the right word, and also, in a way, restorative or redemptive. Mm. It can help you come to terms with how what relationships have gone bad in your life, and it can help you figure out how to be in a relationship differently, not in the abstract, but in the present with the therapist. And that's why I think that whole placebo effect I was describing before is important and shouldn't be dismissed.
Mm. Chris, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. I'm interested in what we are understanding about what makes us happy. You write about Martin Seligman, the president of the American Psychological Association, developing this idea of what's called, I think, positive psychology. And this idea of human flourishing seems to be the kind of an emerging sentiment. To talk about that, if you would.
Well, Seligman is the former president of the American Psychological Association, who has devoted the last 15 or 20 years of his career and his life to understanding positive what makes people happy.
Yeah.
And you know, he's used a fairly novel approach. He's taken different suggestions about what people can do to make themselves happy, and he's paired them with psychological tests. He has people do these exercises and then take psychological tests. And by that, he has amassed a huge database, mostly via the internet, to indicate what we can do to make ourselves happier. He's also, of course, had to deal with the question of, well, what exactly is happiness? And Seligman actually thinks this is a reasonably trivial question, that happiness is a fairly straightforward thing, that it's a kind of a sense of subjective well-being that encompasses a sense of meaning in your life, positive relationships, and a sense of competence in the world. And his approach is to look very pragmatically at how more people can have more of those qualities.
It's interesting also this idea of the kind of wide-ranging implications for figuring out human flourishing, effects on global warming and other things that seem kind of unexpected, but he writes about that.
The interesting thing about Seligman is that he's a dreamer. He's a utopian, and he may not describe himself that way, but he thinks about this on a global scale, literally a global scale. In fact, one of the things that he's done is he's convinced the U.S. Army that the best way to deal with the potential for post-traumatic stress disorder among soldiers is to effectively inoculate them psychologically against PTSD, to make them more likely to encounter trauma and not be psychologically troubled by it to the extent that they would develop PTSD. And this program is now being deployed on the 1.1 million soldiers in the U.S. Army during their basic training via their drill sergeants. And Seligman believes that this is actually a model for all of us, that if we all were to be given the opportunity to engage in these exercises, that we would be happier people, and that a group of happier people, once we've achieved that, we would be able to, we would just sort of naturally, because it would make us happy, we would reverse the kinds of things that we do. We would stop doing the kinds of things that we do that contribute to global warming. So for Seligman, psychology comes first.
Yeah.
once people are happy and flourishing, they'll automatically do the right thing.
It's interesting. Yeah, Seligman, a dreamer, that's how to sort of put it. I mean, he even talks about, he sort of says that there's some, I mean, you point out that he doesn't quite get his math or his history exactly right, but he sort of figured this kind of human flourishing was the thing that fueled the Renaissance and could fuel another kind of Renaissance.
Yeah, he believes that that if we just turn our attention to, and this by the way, dovetails with a book recently put out by a fellow named by Derek Bach, a fairly prominent American intellectual, called The Politics of Happiness, in which the suggestion is basically that the government not any longer be simply in the business of preventing misery, which, by the way, it's turned out not to be very good at, and get directly into the business of encouraging happiness. And Seligman's view of this is that this is what the Medicis did in Florence in the 15th century, and they decided to put their money into what would make people happy, in their case, art. Now, to me, this is an incredibly naive perspective. It's totally deaf to the reality, among other things, that, you know, Florence, the Medicis, Florence was an oligarchy.
Yeah.
It was run by, you know, the people that had the money, and there was plenty of misery. And Seligman's idea that we can all be happy is very reminiscent of something that Alexis de Tocqueville said when he toured America in the early 19th century. He noticed that there was this tendency among Americans to look for subjective well-being before taking into account what it actually meant on a collective level. And he said that the people that simply ask their government to provide them with well-being is the people that awaits the hand that will bind them. That it's a great way to get yourself dependent on a dictator. I don't think Seligman intends that, but I also think that he's, you know, that this idea of putting subjective well-being, putting happiness above everything else, and assuming that the world's problems will take care of themselves once that's done, it's not only naive, it's dangerous.
Let's go back to the phones. John is with us in Sherman, Texas. John, welcome.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Doug.
Sure.
Listen, I'll just make a short comment, try and make it short. You know, the whole idea, I think you called yourself a contrarian. I think I'm maybe aligned to that. But the idea that we banter around with this idea of happiness, I think, in my opinion, I think the patients I see usually drive themselves to their neurosis by our expectation of happiness. I mean, it's just incredible in society that, you know, when you watch TV and look at everything we do, we're striving to not suffer, which is kind of inevitable. I mean, life is kind of basically seems to be uncomfortable, and it's very hard for anybody to tolerate that. Now, albeit, you know, I believe we can attach to joys in life, and I think certain people have serious organic illnesses that can be treated medically, you know, people who hallucinate, but for the most part, this idea of happiness is really driving people pretty neurotic.
I couldn't agree more. There's a kind of oppressiveness. I mean, I just wrote this book about depression.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I got asked a lot, you know, when I was touring around with it and getting interviewed and stuff, is, well, people wanted to talk to me about happiness, and I realized happiness isn't all that interesting to me. And one of the reasons it's not that interesting to me is because it doesn't seem to me to be very a realistic possibility in the long run. Life is, as the caller just said, and I think put it really well, it's uncomfortable. And there is always the opportunity for joy. But to build a psychotechnology or a life, or in Seligman's view, a society around being happy, it just seems to me to create these expectations that the caller is talking about, which become oppressive. Mm. And everybody who's ever been depressed knows that one of the first responses you get, at least in this country, is, come on, buck up, as if you're violating some kind of basic law by being down in the mouth.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is a kind of oppressive ideology that, you know, there's a lot worse oppressive ideologies, like the ones that keep people enslaved and so on. I mean, I don't want to overstate the case. We have the luxury to think about these things. Yeah. But it's an oppressive ideology that has, in my view, infected at least this is what I saw at this conference, it's infected psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. The combination of the expectation of quantifiable results with the relentless focus on happiness is turning therapy into, it's worse than psychobabble, it's just banality.
You know, I wondered, maybe let me ask you this finally. So where does all of this leave Freud? And the way people are thinking about Freud these days is more than just an historical figure. How many of his ideas and kind of endure? And what is the legacy, do you think, of Freud at this point?
Well, I think at one level, Freud is completely forgotten, or else he's a laughingstock, which is what I found at the conference. There were many jokes about Freud, and he deserves it because he made some pretty bad mistakes having to do with thinking that he was onto a theory of human nature when he was really just onto the way life was at the turn of the century in Vienna. But at the same time, everybody who thinks of themselves as having an unconscious life, everybody who thinks of themselves as sort of striving with themselves to be something more than they are, everybody that believes that our behavior and our experience is meaningful and determined by our psychological reality is indebted to Freud. That was Freud's idea. That was the big change in how we saw ourselves, that maybe somebody else would have come up with the idea, but Freud got there first.
Mm. Quick final question. How are people reacting? What's the reaction so far
to
the article?
I haven't had that much reaction. I mean, for the most part, people come out of the woodwork and they cheer you on. They say, oh, good for you for saying these things.
Yeah.
I haven't heard back from the people that I'm critical of, and I probably won't.
Gary Greenberg, his article, The War on Unhappiness, Goodbye Freud, Hello Positive Thinking, appears in the September issue of Harper's Magazine. He joined us from his office in New London, Connecticut. Gary Greenberg, thanks very much for the time.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to be here.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.